Radio Newark, the home of Radio Newark Sport. Weeknights from 7. Radio Newark Sport. Brought to you with Smith's Timber Merchants. For all your fencing, decking and DIY needs on Appleton Gate, Newark. Visit smithstimber.co.uk.
You know, I can't believe how lucky you are out there in Newark. Every evening, the sun comes out. And every evening, you get Tony Smith on your radio. What more could you ask for? Apart from Fridays and rain. Tonight, we hopefully begin the show with a superstar of the future we're trying to contact her now. And then we're going to move on to a superstar of the past, a golden oldie. But he can still cycle to Ollerton back from South Muscombe in an hour. Takes me that long to drive. An hour? South Muscombe? There's hills!
I know.
Big ones! Especially the one that you come back up at Ompton, is it? No way. No way. Right. Tony's got a job to do, and I've got to tell you what's going off in local sport. And Harry Wainwright had a day to remember at the weekend in his last outing at PFI Fullback. He was the fastest in the timed qualifying and won all three heats. But he had to settle for second place in the final. A lot of points earned for the young man, which puts Harry back in the top two for the overall championships. Well done, Harry. And another well done to Olivia Mathias, and she's won a bronze medal at the ETU Triathlon Junior European Cup race in Hungary, nearly the same. So Olivia Mathias continuing that great form that she has. And success to Newark Rowing Club at the St Neers Regatta, with two golds for the under 14 girls and the Masters pairs. Excellent.
This is Radio Newark Sport.
Our main subject tonight is cycling. And if we talk cycling, of course, we've got to talk to Newark's cycling professional, David Miller. And he's going to be with us for the next hour when we cover everything that we've got cycling. Not only are we going to look at his career, we're going to look back at the Tour de France, and we're going to look forward to what promises to be one of the biggest sporting events in Newark for many a long year, when the Tour of Britain actually finishes a stage in little old Newark. Mansfield to Newark via quite a lot of different plays. So while Tony gets hold of Anna, we'll just say good evening to David Miller.
Good evening, Mick.
You're going to get used to David, because he's coming up this week and next week. But as I start talking to David, you can guarantee Tony does his job, and we're going to go straight to the telephones and say good evening to the wonderful, the fantastic, the brilliant Anna Smith. Anna, good evening.
Hi.
What a performance. What a week. Have you come back down to earth yet?
Not quite. I'm still getting over it a bit.
Right. Let's just sort of remind everybody. It was the Commonwealth Youth Championships. Yes. You was in the Bahamas. Yes. You was representing England. Yes. At the 1500 metres. Now, when you went out there, where was you ranked when you went out there, Anna?
In the UK rankings first. I think I was fourth in the UK.
Fourth in the UK rankings, and in the world rankings?
I'm not sure, but I know in the race I was ranked
10th. Right. So you was expected to finish that race in 10th position.
Yes, on my time, yeah.
Right. The email I got from a very proud father said that Anna Smith ran a superb battling race to finish fourth. Overall, fourth overall. That's fantastic, absolutely fantastic.
Thank you.
With a 5 second personal best time of 4:17.9. Now, this is really.
Nine.
I'll stick with nine, sounds better. This is what hits home now. The 11th fastest 1500 by a UK under 17 of all time, and you are now ranked 8th in the world this year.
Yeah.
Anna, how old are you?
15.
15?
Yeah, but 18.
I know. Just talk me through the highlights of that's obviously the highlight of the race. Just talk me through your week, Anna.
I think I was a bit nervous going into it because obviously we're staying over at Heathrow. I was doing a long haul flight, which I wasn't used to. But it was amazing to travel with the team and get to know all the people within the team who were doing all different events at different times, doing different distances, throws, jumps. And then obviously when we got to the hotel, we were staying with Australia, Canada, New Zealand, Scotland, Wales, Kenya, Jamaica, all kinds of different countries from all around the world that you just bump into in the hotel. And it was just really interesting, such a good experience to meet all people from different countries and then be able to compete on the first day. Just have a race I was really proud of and feel like I really achieved something, and then to be able to go and support everyone else on all the different days afterwards.
When did you meet up with Father?
I got to see him the day before my race, and a little bit after my race, and then the day after my race.
So let's do the race itself now. There was no heats, it was straight into the final.
Yeah, it was the first final of the competition.
The first final, crying.
Yeah.
So how did you feel when you sort of walked out onto the track? Because you must have been the youngest.
I wasn't technically. The other girl from England is a month younger than me. But we are pretty much the same age.
Yeah.
I think we were the youngest in the race, I think.
And was it a normal Anna Smith type race, or did you change things around a bit?
I died a lot at the end. I was very tired at the end, which is usually when I've got a sprint and I've got something less. But I think we did such a fast first lap, and we did such a fast few first laps actually, that I think I was just dying at the end. I was very tired.
But the temperature and the humidity as well, Father tells me, was...
Yeah, the humidity and temperature really got to me in the last bit. And then I think that's when I lost my medal, just in the last 70, 50 metres.
But you can't be disappointed,
sure. I'm not disappointed,
surely.
It was just... No, it didn't... I didn't really know how it was going to go, to be honest. I didn't really have a plan for it. I think I didn't know what kind of race it was or how people would run it.
You set yourself a heck of a standard now, 5 seconds off that PB. And reading those stats again, and I will keep reading them, the 11th fastest sort of all time by a UK under 17 runner.
Yeah.
You've moved the bar just a fair few rungs higher, Anna. You've now got to go out and do it again.
Oh yeah.
what happens now then, Anna, for the rest of this summer? Is that racing? Is it time for that Wuthering End rest?
I've got a rest for a while. My next race is nationals, I think, the Triple A's, the national champs, which is in Bedford. I think that's mid to late August.
Right.
So I've got a bit of a rest, and then after the week after that, I've got school games where I'm doing the 800 at school games.
Because you still had this debate with yourself, didn't you? 800, 1500 metres?
Yeah, I got selected for the 800 though, for the school games.
Have you decided in your own mind what you're going to concentrate on?
I don't know. I really don't know. I like both of them for different reasons.
What did the England coaches say after the race?
They all said that I had a really good race. They were impressed by my race. Lots of the people in the team congratulated me. It was a very close knit team. Everyone would support everybody else and respect if other people had races, or if they needed help, they would be able to help them. And everyone would go out to cheer and support, spectate. So we'd watch everyone's races, cheer them on. So I think overall, the team with the managers and the team members, the athletes, it was all very much, it was very supportive, and everyone would just congratulate you for your performance.
When we sit here in 10, 15 years' time and we talk about Anna Smith's career and all the Olympic Games and everything you've been to, you're going to go back and remember this week with special fondness, I think. This is the week that really put Anna Smith on the national map.
Hopefully.
Anna, we're all so, so proud of you here at Radio Newark and everybody at Newark, and I know all the people at Newark Athletic Club still keep an eye on you, and they are so, so proud that their Anna Smith and our Anna Smith has achieved that. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
I can't say any more than what we've said all this year, because 2017 is the year of Anna Smith, because you are absolutely, go on Tony, I'll say it, you say it, a legend. Tony?
Absolute legend, well done.
Thank you.
Anna, we'll talk to you again soon. Well done, and thank you very much for talking to Radio Newark.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Anna Smith, David, 15 years old doing that. Does that take you back to when you was hitting the big scene?
It has, actually. Just listening to her and her enthusiasm and the experience she's had. It's all stepping stones, and what you said, hopefully there'll be Olympics to follow, Commonwealth Games, and a big career in front of her, by the sound of things.
Will she remember this
week?
Absolutely.
I can remember I raced for England the first time. I was 15 years old, and never forget it. I was a nervous wreck.
And that's one of the stories David's going to tell us tonight as we go through his life in the saddle, so to speak. My little notes say during the 1970s, Newark Castle Cycling Club had an influx of young riders, producing a national schoolboy champion in 1972. Our Mr. Miller here. David then turned professional and won two national road racing titles in 85 and 87, and raced extensively in France and Belgium.
That's right, yep. Just before I turned pro, I lived in France for 3 years. That was a big shock to the system. I did an apprenticeship first before I went, and then as soon as I moved out to France, I couldn't speak a word. Thought I could, because I thought I'd listened at school, but I didn't. That's when it starts to hit you. And
Was it My Name Is David and I Am 11?
I couldn't even say that. I think it was Je M'appelle Philippe. But I got dropped into a flat on a Friday, and the English guy that was out there already said, we'll see you Sunday. And I can remember this as vivid as anything. I said, what do I do till Sunday? And he opened the fridge door. The fridge was empty, and he said, I'd find a supermarket if I was you. And that was it. They walked out the door and come back on Sunday to pick me up to take me to my first race. So that was, again, you remember it like it was yesterday. It was so difficult. And, you know, people tell you to try hard at school, and you might need these things that you do at school. You don't think at the time that you do.
Well, we're going to start right at the beginning in a few minutes' time. Before then, the Tour de France has just finished, and I've been rattling on all week about Sir Bradley winning and Wiggins winning it once, and Chris Froome winning it four times. I'm not a great fan of giving night tours to people until they actually finish the sport, because it just sets a precedent, and it looks so bad then that Chris Froome has now won it four times and has not been recognised. What is it, David, that the British sporting public doesn't like about Chris Froome? There's something there that it just doesn't. I know what he's going to say, he's not English, but that's not the point. It's there's something there with Chris Froome that people cannot.
I'm totally with you, but I don't know the answer. He is English as far as I'm concerned.
I didn't say he wasn't English, I said he was born in Kenya.
Yeah, he was, yeah. I don't know, the French, I really didn't get the French booing him last week. They were booing him when he was chasing to get back. He'd had some mechanical difficulty. And I just don't get it. When I lived in France, I was accepted. I did learn to speak the language, and so has Chris Froome, but the sounds of things. I don't get why he's so disliked.
I mean, I've tried to look back and I can't see where he's done something badly wrong to alienate everybody. I just can't see it.
I think if it's anything, it's Team Sky. They've changed the way of racing, and I particularly don't like their way of racing. I don't like the radios, the fact they have radios and the director of sport used to have TVs in the car. It takes away the impulse and the impulse attacks on the road. They're letting people go every day. They're letting a breakaway go. They can work out. They know how many watts they can churn out for how long. So it's making the race so boring because everybody knows the brake's going to go away and 20 kilometres from the end it's going to get caught again unless something bizarre happens. So it's not like the racing, as and I don't like saying it, as we used to know it, but I really do not like the radios.
Has technology ruined cycle racing? Because that's almost the implication of what you're saying.
I wouldn't say all technology, because the bikes are fantastic. It's like cheating getting on a carbon bike nowadays to the old steel bikes. They do go faster. They're more rigid. You press on and you go forward. I just don't like the radios. I just prefer you had to be tactically aware yourself in our day. And that sounds really bad going back to our day and trying to, as if we're insinuating our day was better.
Sorry to interrupt, but in your day, was you racing with a team or was you racing as an individual member of a team, but he was racing as an individual and it was almost every man for himself? Because quite clearly now the rest of the Sky team are racing to make sure one man wins.
No, we race as a team. You was always in a team, and you change your tactics on the road. If one of your team members got into a break and he was looking good that day, you'd leave it, whereas nowadays you're all linked up to the radio. You can find out how he's feeling while he's in that break, whereas in the past you just had to rely on him being good. He's up there and there's nothing really, there's no information you can get on how he's feeling, whether he thinks he's going to win. Nowadays he can tell his director sportif, no, get them to get this break back. They could chase the break down if he's not feeling good. You know, there's lots that can happen now through technology. So it just makes it a bit, to me, it makes it a bit negative. And Team Sky are so strong. They have riders purposely just to sit on the front. So do most teams. I mean,
they're doing a job they get paid for.
I think one guy did about 1,500 kilometres on the front, a guy from Lotto. That was his job, just to keep the race together for the sprinters. They're strong guys.
I don't think there's anything at all wrong with saying in my day it was better, if it was.
Well, I can't say it was, Tony. I can't say it was. I still like watching the sprints and the mountains and the speeds they're going up the mountains these days.
Yeah, but me and Mick often have this conversation about football. In our day, it was a hell of a lot better than it is now, because these days it's all about money. When we first fell in love with football, it was who had the most points.
Yeah.
And now it's solely money based.
I must admit, I did watch a game the other night. I watched Mansfield against Middlesbrough.
Yeah, I changed the show around.
Sorry about that. And I must say, most of the time the ball was spent going across the pitch rather than forwards and backwards. It was just keep the ball and pass it across the pitch. It was quite boring.
Right, onward. These two are chattering away there.
We're old friends.
Like a couple of old women, sort of natter knitter club. Really?
Natter knitter?
Knitter natter, that's it. One of them.
We can edit that one.
We'll start again. Blah, blah, blah. We've done that before. Why cycling, David? When did you get the cycling bug? Let's go back to right at the beginning, because in the early 90s, when you was young, you either played football or rugby, but what gave you that cycling bug?
I loved football, wanted to play football, wanted to be a footballer, and then at the age of 12 or 13 I realised I wasn't going to make it. And the race came to Newark, the pros came to Newark, there was a town centre race. I went down to watch it. It was raining, they were falling off everywhere on the cobbles, and it was quite entertaining, and I thought, I fancy that. And I had a racing bike, promised my mum I'd join the cycling club, and that's what I did. I went and joined the cycling club straight after,
And so where was the cycling club then?
It was based down where the cattle market is. We had a fantastic club room, one of the best in the country, and we're always bleating on about this. We had a lot of youngsters there. It was like we had it like a youth club on a Friday night, club night. There was pool tables, darts, anything that was competition, we did it on a Friday night. But it was also a base for the time trials. There was less traffic on the road, so we used to race on the open roads with the men. And there was just a lot of competition in the club, from schoolboys to juniors and then through to the seniors. So that's where it started. And then as I got a bit older, I realised I needed a bigger club, probably like Anna that you've just been talking to. And I moved clubs to get into a team. It was Chesterfield that I went to, and we just went on from there.
Why Chesterfield?
They just had a good set of riders. They had some international riders riding for them, so probably once or twice a month we'd all be in a big race together, and any one of us could have won, and we did. You know, we could take on your Manchesters and the London clubs. There was quite a few big clubs from the big cities, and we was well up there.
So what sort of age was you? You know, where are we now, age-wise?
Early 20s, late teens, early 20s.
So
left the Newark club. Newark club was fantastic. We had a coach, and like I say, we had a club room, and they took me basically as far as they could take me, and I needed more. I needed a better team. I needed people to work for me.
Did you become apparent to the guys at Newark as well then? This is, you know, the progression's got to happen.
Yeah, definitely. And there was no bitterness, and I still used to go back to the club nights, ride the local time trials if I was around. But it was getting into that bigger team and getting noticed. Although I didn't ride for England or Britain many, never rode for Great Britain, to be fair. Rode for England and Scotland, funny enough. But I won some big races riding for Chesterfield.
Okay, so you're obviously driving yourself by now, and so you haven't got to get out there. So that makes life slightly easier. So you're at Chesterfield. When was the next stage becoming? When did you start to get noticed?
Well, I was there for a few years, but I actually, within 2 years, I'd up sticks and moved to France. I got an offer to go to this club in France, and I was basically I was semi-professional. They gave me
because in this sort of era then, David, France ruled cycling, didn't it?
France, Belgium, and Italy.
We were sort of on the outside looking in, really, wasn't we?
Yeah, definitely.
You know, we all sort of watched the Tour de France, but if you saw a British person riding it, you think, "Oh, look there!" Isn't that a novelty? But so to get cherry picked to go and earn a living out there,
didn't quite earn a living.
sounds bad.
They provided everything except a wage. I won prize money. The prize money was split between the team, and that's what I lived on. And I was going hungry sometimes. And
there's nothing in the freezer.
You had to sort it out. Yeah, you had to win money, win prizes to eat.
The important question, the first half hour, is: did you find that supermarket?
Yeah, found it. Yeah, I was struggling to find my way home though. And this is a true story. Somebody picked me up one day, took to take me to a race. They dropped me off where the team. There was a big 7-seater team car. And off we went to this race, and when we came back, all my teammates, couldn't speak a word to any of them, they all jumped in the cars and started going home, and I grabbed hold of one and asked him, begging him in English, "Please take me home." And he said, in his broken English, "I know not where you live." "Where you live?" And I said, "I not know." This is true. And all I could tell him was, I remembered the word for station, the gare, and I said, "I live near the gare." So he took me to the station, and then I pointed from there on. And that is gospel truth. So I thought I need to write my address down and keep it with me at all times, just in case. And
joking apart, I mean, it must have been...
It was scary.
Yeah, it had to be. I mean, it must have been brilliant.
It was.
But it had to be scary.
It was fantastic, but it was scary because there was no phones, there was no internet, no mobile phones, none of that. So every now and again, I'd ring home. I'd like have a 2-franc piece that'd last for probably a minute. I'd ring home, just tell everybody I was all right, and good old pen and paper. And my mum's still got the letters that I sent home moaning about this and that. but it's something. I was so hungry to do what I did, and I knew it was going to lead to something else. I knew it was going to lead to a pro career.
You wouldn't regret it.
No, they were the best years. The 3 amateur years in France were the best years. They were better than the pro years because once I started winning races, I realised that I was the king of the club. And the second and third years, every now and again, we'd disappear on holiday. We wouldn't ask to go. We'd just say, look, we're off for a couple of weeks. You knew. I worked out. With the French, they were so far in front of us. They taught me so much about eating, diet, even this is the early 80s, and you just learnt so much. It was like another apprenticeship. It was brilliant. And I actually had a lead out train before they was even invented. There was an ex-pro in the club who I didn't particularly like at the beginning, and he just used to lead me out for the last 3 or 4 kilometres on his own. He was so strong. And you found out that if you got beat on the line, if you didn't win it and you came second or third or whatever, you had to go and face your teammates after. And that was really tough. That brought something else to the game where you feel like you've let the guys down, because we used to get a bonus for a win but nothing for second. So it just taught you lots of things. Taught you lots of things about yourself, living on your own in a foreign country. But it was fantastic. Do it again tomorrow.
What we tend to do on here, because I really don't do a script and you do it, I jump a little bit.
Yep.
And I'm going to jump away from you now and jump to Mark Cavendish, because what you've just said about the sprinting, there's nothing for second.
Yeah.
When Cavendish got injured, or when he was elbowed, or whichever way you want to read it, because as I read it, he was elbowed, yeah, but I also read he's more than capable of elbowing himself.
Yeah.
They're going. I can't see the gap they're going for.
Well, you've got space there. I could see the space there, and the guy, the world champion who actually elbowed him, he had space on the other side. The French guy who won the stage came through so fast. Cavendish was on his wheel, but the other guy just moved straight over, and he'd got room on his left. But I think Cavendish had touched him. And he thought, I'm not going as well, so he gave him the elbow just to make sure he fell the other way. I think he knew Cavendish was going. But there was space there. There was space there.
You could see. To the untrained eye,
yeah,
it just looked chaotic.
He closed the door. He just shut the door, and that's that. That's what... I've done it.
I know he got thrown out.
Everybody does it.
Should he have got thrown out the whole competition then?
I think so.
Yeah.
Because he'd... Earlier on in that, about 2 kilometres to go, he had elbowed somebody else and he caused the crash also in that same stage, just right, with 3 kilometres to go or whatever. And he was a bit reckless, and I think he needed, although it is a loss to the Tour de France because he's a character.
So you're saying that, you know, you get nothing for second then, so you was also a sprinter?
I was a sprinter, yeah.
Yeah.
Couldn't get up a hill to save my life. Avoided Beacon Hill like plague.
How do you manage Ompton?
I can do it now. I've worked it out. If you get it, although I'm not particularly light, but nobody told us at the time that if you lost a bit of weight, just look at Chris Froome, Bradley Wiggins. There's a formula. There's a power output and a weight. You multiply them or divide them or whatever, and it will give you a number. And if you can get to 6.5 to 6.7, you're capable of winning the Tour de France. It's as simple as that. Your power and weight. And them guys, there was Steve Cummins, I think it was. I read one of his training rides a couple of years ago, and he was trying to lose some weight but retain his power. And he did something like, I don't know, 120 miles on 2 cups of coffee and 2 halves of energy bars. And if anybody's ridden a bike, if you ride a long way without putting food inside you, you hit the wall. And he must have gone through the wall and carried on and rode out the other side. It's just unbelievable. But just to fat burn, basically, and get his weight, keep his weight down.
I know you're keen on football, even though you do support the Smoggies. We have a look at the football transfer window every night, just so we can talk about ridiculous amounts of money. So let's see who's in the news tonight.
Radio Newark Sport, brought to you with Smith's Timber Merchants for all your fencing, decking and DIY needs.
And feel free, David, to join in on any of these. Manchester City are trying to beat Real Madrid for the signing of the 18-year-old Monaco forward Kylian Mbappe. City are prepared to pay £160 million for the French international. We said last night they'd already spent £211 million in this transfer window, and now they're going to bid another £160 million. Tony's trying to figure out where financial fair play is in all this, and I'm not really sure any of us will ever figure that one out, but it's an obscene amount of money, it really is. Arsenal are trying to set up a deal to sign the 21-year-old Monaco midfield player Thomas Lemar, a £45 million deal. They're going to be the richest club in France, but they're going to have nobody left. Because they're the champions, aren't they? They beat PSG to the championship. Mm. But they've been cherry-picked, aren't they?
Yep.
They're just being picked off.
Well, they seem to be selling the whole squad.
Yes. Barcelona have sent officials to England to try and find Philippe Coutinho. I'll come back to that one in a moment. After Liverpool rejected a £72 million bid, they insist is not for sale. We will see. Reds manager Jurgen Klopp says the club are not afraid to spend heavily this summer as they continue to pursue Virgil van Dijk, the one that's training on his own because he's got the hump. Our list that we made at the weekend, the ones that we saw at the weekend, David, and we keep going back to them. Jack Wilshere apparently is for sale. We didn't work out whether he was going to go to Turkey, Sampdoria, West Ham or Newcastle. He's now said he doesn't mind where he goes as long as it's near London. Turkey, Sampdoria, Newcastle, West Ham.
That's why I said West Ham the other night.
You did?
Because he doesn't want to leave London.
We'll give you that one. Ross McCormack looks like he's going to Sunderland, which, if nothing else, just proves that Sunderland's in a mess, doesn't it? it really does. The Coutinho one, I still think Liverpool cannot afford to turn £80 million down. They're not that big.
They can.
You
in the
do. I don't.
Climate.
We will see. Especially if they want to sign Virgil van Dijk when he's finished his strike. Because when Sterling went on strike, the Liverpool fans absolutely crucified him. Because he went on strike to get away to Man City.
Yeah.
Don't really see much of a difference, do you?
Van Dijk's going to Chelsea.
Who's Middlesbrough signed? They haven't signed Carl Darlow, have they? Got your own goalkeeper.
Is that who you were talking about earlier?
Well, the Carl Darlow was going to go from Newcastle, but you've got the West Ham man now, haven't you? Anyway, time's running out.
Radio Newark Sport, brought to you with Smith's Timber Merchants for all your fencing, decking and DIY needs on Appleton Gate, Newark. Visit smithstimber.co.uk.
I have often said I do hope other sports don't go the same way as professional football's gone.
Well,
and what you said about cycling tonight, you worry in its own way that
Team Sky, yeah, you know, they are the best. They are the best team. They're the strongest team, and it's fantastic that they're really a British team. But yeah,
well, that simple three-letter word, Sky, has transformed sport totally, hasn't it?
Yeah.
In always, it's anyway. That's my.
But I don't, on the cycling, I don't think it's Sky. I think it is the coaches Brailsford and my old friend Shane Sutton. They're the ones that changed cycling.
But somebody's paying them.
They are paying them, but it was their brainchild. And
yeah,
just for your information, because I know you'll be interested in this, I was sat outside Grove Sports Centre where my kids were at swimming club. Can't remember how many years ago. And I was talking to Shane Sutton, and he told me then, he said, we're going to have a tour, somebody on the podium in 5 years at the tour. And I said, who is it? Because I thought, I'll get a sneaky bet on. And he said, I don't know yet, Dave. He said, we haven't found him yet. And it was all to do with this formula that I mentioned earlier. Yeah. And it turned out to be Bradley Wiggins. But that was a long time before anybody else, it had been released to anybody else. and I thought
he was right.
I thought he'd been drinking again. But fantastic. And it's, yeah, they've been given the tools to do the job.
Anyway, little boy lost to an extent in France.
Yeah.
Turns very quickly into a big boy winning.
Yeah, I won 45 races in 3 years in France. And absolutely loved every minute of it. I loved the French. I loved the way they eat. I loved everything about France. Unfortunately, I couldn't get a pro contract in France. And I got offered a contract for Rally, who were pretty big in England then, big bike manufacturer, and came home 1984.
And was that a wrench, or was it just financial?
I really wanted to stay in France, but I didn't want another year of doing what I'd just done. It was definitely a step up, and I was getting paid as well, so it wasn't a wrench, but it was a good decision. Turned out to be a bad one.
45 races, a hell of a lot of races, but the best of the memories?
There was several. We, a friend through cycling, I was at, and this sounds morbid, I was at a funeral in Liverpool, and there was a lot of cyclists there, and a guy came across to me that I'd raced with. He was part of the Britain's Worlds team. And we was competing for our club against the world's team. The British were there, the French, Dutch. And I won a stage of this race, and I won it quite easily. And he came across just to say, I remember that day. He said, you were awesome. You beat all of us. We were going to the Worlds. We couldn't believe you, why you weren't in the world's team. So that was a big race, and it was a good memory. I can still remember it. But I just think the whole shooting match of going to France, the whole experience, it made me a different person. I think it made me into, shaped me into the person I am, really.
The obvious next question, of course, is when did you fall in love?
With what?
Your
with
wife!
With my wife.
I thought he was back on the bike again.
We know what the first love is, and I suppose she knows what the first love
funny
is.
Funny enough, she worked for Rally. So she was in the marketing department at Rally.
Now it comes together.
It was, I've got to say, it was love at first sight, but it wasn't really. But
is she listening?
Probably not. she hates anything about bikes now, although she started riding a bike herself now. It took her 30,
it took a long time,
took her 30-something years to realise that that's the future. But no, she worked at Rally, and we met, and... we both got sacked in the same week, funny enough.
I'm not going to ask what for, then.
Well, I'm going to tell you anyway.
Didn't involve a Birkenstock.
Tony, put your hands in your ears for the next bit.
Was that another story?
Well, I got glandular fever after the third race. I rode it as a pro. I realised there was something wrong. Diagnosed with glandular fever. Had 6 or 7 weeks off the bike. Came back. Was really unfit compared to everybody else. It took me 3 months. I actually won a race in July. The day after, I went to race in Belgium, and I was involved in a crash where I broke my jaw and cheekbones. So I was in hospital for 2 weeks in Belgium. Had my jaw wired together for 6 weeks, so it was another 6 weeks off the bike. And by the time I got going again, I got third in a British title on the track. And then within a month of that, I got told that they wouldn't keep me on for the next year. So, and at the same week, my wife got made redundant. So,
so you've had better weeks.
Well, I lived not far from you down Queen Street at the time. It was a black armband for me. But I took the positives out of it and saw it. I managed to get a contract for the next year with a guy who actually organises the Tour of Britain now. And he realised, well, I don't know whether he realised, but he helped me out, found me a team, and he became my manager for a couple of years. And the next year was when I won the British title, and a guy from Rally was second in that race, which was... That was one of before you ask, that was one of the best moments, not actually winning the race, but I can remember going to the dope control straight after the race, and all the managers were queued up outside the dope control. And I just saw the guy from Rally, and he couldn't even say well done. He couldn't say anything. And just as I went in the door to the dope control, I heard him say, I don't know what I'm going to put in my report to Rally about who's won this race. And I think that was probably the best moment of my cycling career, to be fair. Not actually crossing the line with my arms in the air, it was just hearing him saying that. Not bitter or anything.
No, you're not coming over as bitter, no.
Exactly. Not the slightest. But, yeah, so it's the world of tough knocks, you know. You dust yourself down, you get up and get on with it again, or you just pack up and wither away, and I'd got a bit more left in me, and... I still wanted to do it. Still wanted to ride the bike.
Tony, you'd be reporting on David, would you? Did your times clash?
Yeah,
or?
I did, yes.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I think you were there right from the start of my advertiser career. I started in 86, and I think we were...
I used to get a phone call every Monday morning from Tony. Have you done anything this week? I haven't got much to print.
Yeah, that's
not
true.
Not much football in the middle of summer. Yeah.
And Tuesday and Wednesday. Yeah. But yeah, we became firm mates. And then there's one, I think it was a promotion for the Newark Town Centre cycle race. That I can't remember the year. But I remember we had to take a picture of you outside. And I've put on a few pounds over the years, Mick. It's safe to say. And Dave got stripped next to me into his cycling gear for this kit, and it was just embarrassing. But he stood next to you, mate.
Could you still see David?
And I was quite, for a cyclist, compared to what they are today, the build of a cyclist today, I was 11 and a half stone.
Yeah, but you were ripped, weren't
you? I was ripped. I had a six-pack before they were fashionable. And I didn't even realise I'd got it.
He buys a six-pack most nights.
I don't know where it's gone. But, and again, times have changed with cycling, because most of us were very similar to me. The hill climbers were a bit smaller. Hmm. But, times have moved on now, and you've got to be 67 kilos now, so you're not going to be doing anything in a big bike race.
Did you do all your riding outside then? Because the question is now that on the back of the Kennys, as they are now, and
Boardman, really.
You know, well, he started it off, didn't he? But again, we've turned these riders into world names and world Olympic champions. Did you ever go on the Velodrome at all? Or is that not something that you fancied?
No, I loved the track. It was my favourite discipline, but there was just not the races and not the money to be earned riding the track. There was no indoor tracks in Britain when I was racing. The best track was at Leicester, a wooden outdoor track, which meant when it rained, you had to sit and wait for the track to dry. And I've spent hours and hours at Saffron Lane, just waiting for the track to dry so we could finish our racing or whatever. Nottingham, there was the best track league in the country was at Nottingham on a Wednesday night at Harvey Haddon. And those guys came, some came up from as far as Luton, Sheffield. That was a great track league, because when you're on the track at the age of 16, you're in with the seniors. So I was racing against people who were riding Commonwealth Games and probably Olympics, a guy called Ian Hallam, Jeff Cook. So you got told, you got put in your place. You did anything wrong in a bunch, you got put in your place good and proper. And it was a fantastic schooling, and I agree with the British cycling. They've developed, most of the road riders have come through a track system. Obviously they've got the indoor velodromes now, which are fantastic, and I must take you to Derby because you can have a taster session. In fact, the pair of you never did get Tony Smith on a bike.
That's one thing I would try. They're not going to get me running, and they ain't going to get me swimming. That's one thing.
I'll do that for the. We can book on, and you can go. You get taught,
because
you're on a fixed wheel with no brakes, by the way, as well.
Christ.
With a load of other people that are doing it for the first time.
I'll drive and just watch, mate.
Oh no.
We keep a close eye on Finlay and Leo
Bass,
Ivan's boys.
Yeah.
And Finlay was telling me of his fist. I didn't realize there's about a 30-foot drop from the top of this to the. It doesn't look like that on television.
I don't do heights, Dave.
I took I took some of my mates over to when before Derby was built. We went to Manchester for the day to do one of these taster sessions, and I took them to look at the track, and the steepest part is just coming out of the banking. So I made sure I took them to that was their first sight of the track, and they looked down, and they all went quiet. And I said to them, there was people riding around the track, and I said, Poppy, my daughter, she was probably 9 or 10 at the time, I said, she's been on here, she was on the other week. I said, no pressure, but it took her about 4 laps to get up to the top, to get up to the fence. She was straight up there, no fear. And
that doesn't surprise me with Poppy.
And they all looked at me and thought, oh dear. And but it's the way you're actually taught, the coaching staff, all again through British Cycling and the way cycling's evolved in Britain, they all know what they're doing and they're all very, very good at the job.
Got to go to a quick break, but the last Olympics, when Jason Kenny nearly got disqualified and then he didn't get disqualified, and we sat in our little lighthouse on holiday in Cornwall, and like the rest of England was chewing your fingernails, should he have been disqualified?
That was for coming past the motorbike, wasn't
yes.
it? Yeah. I think...
Or if they're disqualified, they'd have to disqualify half of them.
It was the same as Vicky Pendleton got disqualified for going through in the pursuit too quick. She went through before the line, but it's marginal. I don't think there was any gain.
It's a lot easier to chuck the man out that rides the motorbike.
The problem is, and I'm going to go
best decision.
I'm going to go back to our day. The Kieran, the motorbike went a lot faster. So with a lap to go, I know we was on a 300-meter track instead of 250. The last lap, the motorbike pulled off, and you were going full speed then. Nowadays, they wind it up for another 3 or 4 laps after the motorbike's pulled off. But because that happened, everybody wanted to be behind the motorbike. You couldn't be last because you weren't even going to get in the top three. So it became a bit of a fight, a lot of a fight. And in those days, you were allowed to use your elbows. You're allowed to use your head. You could headbutt somebody legally. And or your knee, if you stuck your knee on somebody's elbow, if you just flicked your knee out on somebody's elbow on the handlebars, you know, it threw them offline, and you're doing 35-40 mile an hour at the time.
Sounds more like rollerball.
It was fantastic, Tony. I loved it. Absolutely. I didn't like being on the receiving end, obviously, but we've had a few good skirmishes on the track.
Tell us about them in a couple of minutes. In the T20 Blast, Worcestershire made 208 for 8 for their 20 overs, so Notts 209 to win between innings at the moment. That will be a doddle for the Outlaws, he says, full of confidence.
Should be.
I haven't got long to go. Now, the good news is that David's coming back next week, and the even better news is he's bringing his daughter Poppy with him. Now, Poppy, as some of you may remember, he went to France, she disappeared off to America to play football, to earn a living playing football. That's one story. But that story is involved into a second one, David, hasn't it? She's now commentating on the game.
She is, yes. She's got a job with, it's like a championship level soccer team.
She doesn't speak like that now, does she?
I'm not so sure.
Oh.
But she's the analyst. She doesn't. They've got a great commentator. The club and most of the game. Well, all the games go out to about 6 countries. It's streamed to 6 countries. There's a lot of foreign guys that play for the club, and she's doing really well, and she's loving every minute of it.
So it's very worrying, Tony, because I think next week Poppy can sit where I'm sitting, and I'll sit with you lot over there. So Poppy's going to come in to talk about American
soccer.
There you go. You see, we've got a team effort there. And we will find time next week to talk at length or a little bit more about the Tour Brent coming to Newark, as opposed to the 4 minutes that we've got to talk about it now. But I wasn't going to... It's been fascinating, Tony. Very rarely we'd give the whole hour up.
That's been the fastest hour we've had.
We've more or less done that tonight, and we've never done that in the past, but it's been absolutely fantastic. The Tour Brent coming to Newark, how good is that?
Oh, it's fantastic. I think for the county, for Newark, Nottinghamshire, it can show off all the fantastic places for the tourism industry, and just for the cyclists, just the sporting occasion. It'd be fantastic. It'd be massive.
And we're not just sitting back. Or we're not. The cycling community is not just sitting back on its laurels and standing there waving your Union Jack. You're actually putting on a festival of cycling.
Festival, yeah, absolutely. There's something going off every day for a week. The biggest part of that is we're putting a youth's race on, children's races, youth race, and I'm trying to push for like a corporate race, so we can get some company bosses having a race around the circuit as well.
You supplied the bike. I know a couple from here who we could put. Yes, I'm in for that.
I'm looking at Tony. I'm looking at Tony again.
Here. No, I'm looking at payback time.
the problem we've got is the daylight. We're struggling for time. But I would love to do that just to get people involved in the sport.
Yes.
Are we talking breakfast deal?
Yes.
Sorry, Matt and Vicky. It's all his fault.
I'm sure we can find some bikes. But yeah,
I'll find the riders. You find the bikes.
It's all to create a legacy. The cycling club. Since we lost that clubhouse we talked about, the cycling club itself has struggled to function. Now they've got a fantastic set of young riders in the club. Parents are very active. We're trying to get this cycle circuit built on Elm Avenue as part of the sports hub. It looks like I'm hoping we're still there with it, but it's not set in stone yet.
Because it's been there and it's not been there and it keeps coming and going.
And I think that is a key point for the legacy. And we just want to get as many people involved and on our side as possible.
It's potentially going to be a fantastic week, isn't it? It's got all the ingredients.
The tour of Britain. The one downside to it is it's 10 seconds. They'll be through Newark. By the time they actually get into Newark, I'd say probably 3 minutes of actual.
Yes.
By the time they come down Beacon Hill, within 3 minutes they'll be
crossing
the line.
What speed are they coming down Beacon Hill at?
They'll be moving down there because I think it will be one of the best stages. You don't need hilly, you don't need home moss and really hilly circuits to have a good race. And I think my prediction already, from Retford to Newark, I think it will get split to pieces with the crosswinds. I think the wind will have a massive effect. So it all depends. But somebody chasing a breakdown, or if the race is split to pieces, the group's all over the place. They'll be touching 45, 50 mile an hour coming down Beacon Hill.
Well worth looking at. David, thank you so much. And we'll see you again next.
Great stuff. Thanks for
next Wednesday.
Me.
Tomorrow, Becky Gallup's coming in to talk about the half marathon while Tony goes off to continue his world domination of Newark sport. We must end, though, with a little announcement, and we do apologise to any listener that may have nightmares at the prospect of Matt Colborne dressed in Lycra on a cycle. We'll try our best to save you from that. But until then, don't have nightmares. Bye-bye.